I'd love to introduce our speaker today and get going. So first announcement is those perfectly good white sign-in sheets are perfectly good white sign-in sheets. So if you would sign in for me, that'd be great. We love knowing who's here. As I said the other day, on Friday when we had a different brown bag, it's amazing how quickly the time goes. It's hard to believe that we're about to be in April, and then we'll take the summer off, and then we'll start again in the fall. But we have two brown bags in April. I ran out of buff-colored stationery, so everything's on white today. So Maita Tapia, one of my colleagues, is going to be doing a presentation on Friday, April 10th, called Organizing the Fragmented Workers, Unions, and the Fast Food Industry, which should be very, very hot topic. So I'll send those around. Maita is one of our newest faculty members at the School of Human Resources Labor Relations and is really doing cool work on worker organizing generally and also looking at kind of new forms of worker organization. Then I'm very happy to welcome, you know what I did? I made a mistake.
No.
I know, it happens. So forget the one I was going to hand you, because the fact that it has the wrong date on it. So instead, I will tell you that Peter Cole will be coming. I'll send this around. This is the entire semester schedule. Peter Cole will be coming from the History Department at Western Illinois University, and he'll be speaking on the topic on the waterfront in Durban and San Francisco, longshoremen and social movement unionism, 1934 to 1994. So Peter does work both in America and in South Africa. I know him from his South African work since I worked there as well. So do come back for that. And let me thank a lot of co-sponsors for today's talk, the Chicano Latino Studies Program, the Julian Zamora Research Institute, the MSU Center for Gender and Global Context, and the MSU Women's Resource Center. So we're very happy to have Jane, who directs the Women's Resource Center, and Sheila, who directs CLS here on campus today with us, and thank you for all of you coming. Now, this talk originally got snowed out, and I was very happy to be able to get it rebooted in terms of a new date quickly. Maria Katera is connected to two fabulous organizations over at the University of Michigan, the Women's Studies Program on the one side and the American Studies Program on the other. Both of them are absolutely first rate, and we're very, very happy to have Maria here. She did her PhD at Stanford and then came directly to the University of Michigan. As I said, nothing like grabbing for the brass ring and getting it straight out of graduate school. But if you look at her vita and everything else she's been doing, well-deserved to be at a top-flight institution. I think we'll be very lucky to have Maria Katera in our larger universe here in Michigan for some time. When I talked to Maria about this specific program and everything else, she told me about the oral history work that she's been doing in southeastern Michigan. And I think that oral history is just a fabulous tool for unlocking things that otherwise would go unsaid. Much of history is often the history of, frankly, people who, if you go way back, who were not literate or did not necessarily keep records. And oral history has allowed us to really tap into the life of ordinary people who did extraordinary things. And it's only through oral history that we understand that that's true. Because otherwise they were humble, otherwise they often would not necessarily share out their own personal experience. So Maria today joins us and is talking on Working for Justice, Legacies of Latina Activism in Southeastern Michigan. So please give a warm Our Daily Work, Our Daily Lives welcome to Maria Katera.
Thank you. Well, I want to thank John for inviting me to do this. I've been wanting to come up to MSU for a long time because it's a real center of the kind of work that I'm documenting historically and continuing to the present moment. So I'm really delighted and honored to be here to share this project, which is part of a larger project. So I'm going to try to do a couple of things in one talk. which is going to be challenging. And I don't want it to go too long because I want to leave time for questions. So if you do have questions, I'm going to kind of move through quickly some parts of this talk, but I would love to engage with you in the Q&A. So what I'm going to try to do is talk a little bit about the larger project that the Michigan Project is a part of, right? And that is the Chicana Pormiraza Digital Memory Project. So I'm going to introduce that a little bit and its goals and objectives. And then I'm going to talk about, give a little bit of background. Some of you are going to be very familiar with this background, but most people are not, on the social justice activism that happened in Michigan in the 1960s and 70s. Not a lot of is known or written about it. There are a few exceptions. A lot of the writing, the historical writing, kind of ends with the World War II and doesn't really move us beyond that. Some new writing has been emerging, work by one of your, I think, alums, Nora Salas, for example, writing on the educational, social justice activism around education and educational equity here in the state. That's super, super important work. But so far, it's kind of an open field that still needs a lot of excavation. So I'm going to lay the groundwork in very basic terms for that. And then I'm going to talk about a class, which is the way we've been conducting our oral histories, have been through teaching at the same time as doing the oral history. So I'll talk about some of the dimensions of that and what we do. And through that, talk about some of the women's histories that we've uncovered. And then finally, I want to talk about the importance of public humanities and community engagement in this work. This work is largely, could be only digital, but we're really committed to making sure that there are analog manifestations so that people who aren't connected to the digital or the academic complex can actually engage with products from our research on the ground and in communities. So first, I want to talk about the Chicana Pormiraza Digital Archive. We're actually calling it, lately we've been calling it a digital memory project because it's not like your typical digital archive. So basically I began the project in partnership with a woman named Linda Garcia Merchant, who's an Afro-Chicana filmmaker out of Chicago, in 2009. We were both the children of activists, feminists, Chicana feminists, and we had both noted how recent productions about the second wave of the feminist movement and recent books about Chicano, the Chicano movement hadn't really discussed the role of Chicanas in the movement, in these social movements. So we were very interested in excavating that role, and we had familial connections to that role. And luckily for the project, I had deep networked connections throughout the Southwest, and Linda had very important connections in the Midwest. And so that's a really important part of this project. Because those of you who study Chicano history, I know you probably know that it tends to focus on the Southwest and the configuration of Aslan. And so the Midwest is a big unknown. So our project essentially wanted to create some kind of digital interface for scholars and teachers and students and community members where they could access primary materials and begin to make the documentaries and write the histories that needed to be done, and also to bring them into the process. So the digital enables us to think about how we can make knowledge be an exchange instead of just a top-down delivery model. We were interested in this project, as I said, because of scholarly neglect. And you have the benefit of a fantastic resource here, the Ana Rivera and the Special Collections, that has done an incredible job of collecting Chicano movement materials here at MSU, but not all places have this. And indeed, in many, many of the holdings that do exist of Chicano movement material, Chicanas are almost entirely absent from that. And I think this place is an exception because you have the Juana and Jesse Gonzalez papers that include a phenomenal collection of Chicana feminist material, some of which I'm going to show with your permission, Leanna. I kind of asked you last weekend. There are probably a better formal way. So anyway, I talk a lot about the feedback loop, and basically all that means is that so long as archivists have to kind of reference the extant scholarship to make a rationale for collecting the materials of women, they're up a creek, right? Because the extant scholarship doesn't actually include, to a significant degree, histories of Chicanas in the movement. However, the extant scholarship can't change and include more Chicanas in the movement if there are no archives that scholars can go to write that history. And so one of the ways we think about the project is penetrating or interrupting that feedback loop by creating the documents on the ground that will help writers begin to write this history and excavate this history. There's also the question of access, and I referred to it very briefly just now, but you know, there's the issue of people having access or not to library holdings. And a lot of the women we interview are very concerned that their materials will be put in a collection where people, community members, will not have access to it. And this is connected to the third point, which is this idea of democratizing the archive, creating a kind of open source, or thinking, reimagining the archive as a site of exchange, of knowledge exchange, and not as a repository, as a place of encounter, and not as a place that you go to that is very limited. Only certain kinds of people can experience the encounter with the past. So we're very interested in thinking about what it would mean to open that the library up to a certain extent. But that also means democratizing the other way, right? What would it mean to have people in the community tag objects with metadata, for example, and to bring their knowledges into the in terms of description? There's this idea of virtual reunification, which is kind of a digital humanities term. Why a digital project? This is the sort of so what question. Why do it digitally? Why not just collect? In digital reunification or virtual reunification is when libraries collaborate across the boundaries of nation and state many times to bring formerly dispersed collections together into one single website, for example. We think of reunification as doing that to a certain extent, but also doing something else. Reunifying the sort of political moment of the present to the past. Reunifying a network of Chicanas who once mobilized together and kind of reigniting that network and seeing what happens. And so for us, virtual reunification is not just a reunification of objects, but a reunification of formerly active or reactivation of networks. So the project objectives are first and foremost, as John said, to collect and digitize oral histories. We have to date collected ourselves about 60 oral histories throughout the Southwest and Midwest, but we also work with partner projects in Chicago and Wisconsin to collect locally oral histories there. And the Michigan project that I'm going to describe is one of those kind of nodal projects that's connecting to the main project. We also have a digital collection of around 4,000 objects. Some of them are full print books, right? So what we want to do is create a lending library of out-of-print books that can make information studies, different kinds of materials available for teaching. Our national collaboratory includes, a primary relationship is with the Institute for Computing and Humanities, Arts, and Social Sciences, and they provide our platform. The platform is very important. It's called Medici, and essentially it allows people in multiple locations to upload both objects and metadata. And this is what enables us to have a collaboratory, to work with classrooms remotely to help us do this work. Because Linda and I we don't have the resources or the time to actually travel to all the places where we know, you know, there might be or is history or knowledge. And so the idea is we can work remotely with faculty who want to take on these oral history projects like the one I did here in Michigan, and they can work directly with the Medici system. But the collaboratory also includes collaborations with libraries, teachers, and community organizations. We're currently developing a public website where we can actually do curations. Our website can't be open like without a login to the public, because every woman signs releases where she owns the copyright for her material, but we get to use the digital images. So what we're doing is working with students to design interfaces through our website where they can work individually with the database and then pull out images and do curations either based on bios or based on events or organizations. So that's kind of in process right now. And if you look at our public website, you'll see what I mean by in process. We're building it. As I said before, we're very invested in creating avenues for community collaboration and taking the knowledge that we're collecting and bringing it and putting it back out into the community. And at the end of this talk, I'm going to talk about one such collaboration that we've recently done. At the center of this project is pedagogy. So from the very beginning in 2009, the first time we made a trip to Texas, we took two students with us. The next year we went to California and took three students. So we've always taken undergraduate students with us on these research trips. And the idea is to expose them to the process of oral history, but also like everything about scanning, digitizing, and uploading to Medici, cataloging, doing all the work to build a digital repository. So our students get a lot of on-the-ground training. Most of our students are from the Europe program, University Research Opportunity Program, where they can do work study for research experience. And so it's been a really important opportunity for them. The class that I'm going to talk about today does two things that are connected to this project. One, it operates as a Michigan site. So a site for the collection of histories relevant to Michigan, Chicana histories and Latina histories, actually, relevant to Michigan. And then the other part of this is it was a kind of test case, right, for taking what we do individually with students on these trips and imagining, can this be done in a class? So how would you organize a class around our process of collecting oral histories and digitizing archives? And this is the project status. And I'd be happy to show you Medici after the talk if you have questions about what it looks like and how people would use it. So before moving on to what we did in the class, I think it's important to just lay out some very basic groundwork on what happened in Michigan between 1965 and 1985, the years of our kind of that we're looking at. You know, as I said before, there's a real lack of scholarship on this period. There's a number of papers that were written in the 1970s kind of about the Chicano movement as it was happening. And then there's a real lacuna until recently. There's been more interest in excavating Chicano movement history in Michigan. And as I said, MSU has been a really important site of documenting that history. There's a tendency to think about two things invisibilize Chicano labor movement politics in the Midwest, or specifically in Michigan. One is understanding labor in a very sort of, I wouldn't say reductive way, but focusing a lot on industrial labor. Certainly Mexican Americans were always involved in industrial labor, but when we think about labor issues that really arose in the 1960s, a primary one nationally, of course, is the farm labor. Issues that arose primarily in California, but simultaneously right here in Michigan, and little less is known of that, right? So we had the Farm Labor Organizing Committee that evolved to address the specific needs of people in Michigan. And this is a story that is, a background that's very relevant, because one of the women we interviewed, Emily Martinez, is a migrant education specialist, and she comes by that commitment from her experiences in the fields, right? Which are shared by many, many Latino Michiganders. Not just Mexicans either, also Puerto Ricans, who are braceros. So what less is known about the concerned citizens for migrant workers who organized under the aegis of Ruben Alfaro a march for migrants' rights from Saginaw to Lansing in 1967. So this is actually quite early in the trajectory of farm labor organizing in Michigan. This brought a lot of attention to the problem of, it'll later lead to attention to the problem of migrant education very particularly, but attention to the problem of the conditions of field workers in places like Saginaw, Adrian, Blissfield, and in western Michigan. This is a photo from one of the women whom, the collection of one of the women whom we interviewed in 2013, I'm sorry, Emily Martinez. Her uncle was a major shutterbug, and he took hundreds of snapshots of migrant conditions, unwittingly documenting in many ways the conditions that people like that Ruben Alfaro were trying to bring attention to. These are family photos, essentially, of Emily Martinez's experience migrating from La Feria, Texas, up through West Texas, the Panhandle, picking cotton in Arkansas and Oklahoma, then up to Ohio to pick green beans, and then on to Michigan. And it was a cycle that she and her family engaged in throughout her youth until they settled out, as many migrant families did, in the post-war years during the industrial boom, and got jobs in light industry, actually, in Blissfield. And this is a picture of her tia, her aunt, in cotton a cotton truck in 1947. See, these are very helpfully dated. And this is just a selection from a newspaper that we scanned in, I believe this was in Elena Herrada's collection, just indicating, she actually spoke about going to this event, and so we had it, the advertisement in the newspaper that she had preserved. And you see this is in southwest Detroit on Verner at the AMP, there's a farm workers boycott. Another really important labor struggle that brought Chicanos in Michigan into contact with Chicanos in the Southwest was this, the labor strike that resulted from the garment workers at the Farrah plant in El Paso, who were largely women who had gone on strike because they weren't being allowed to organize. And this was actually, many Chicanos wrote about the Farrah strike. This is a really important nexus of gender and labor that we were very excited to discover in the Michigan archive that we uncovered. This woman is a woman named Jane Garcia's mother, who was came to Detroit in the 1940s and worked at the Texas Cafe for many years. And those of you from Detroit know this was a local hotspot. And Jane, this is her, Ramona Rivera, marching with, I think, a UAW official. Jane could not remember what his name was, but I think he was pretty high up. The UAW played an important role also in connecting agricultural labor issues and supporting agricultural labor boycott initiatives in Detroit and Michigan and Chicago and other places. But I think this confluence is really interesting with Jane's mom holding up the Farrah Slacks sign with the UAW support. Okay. And this is from another woman we interviewed. We interviewed four women, by the way, and I'll talk about them more. Maria Guadiana, she had a lot of buttons. I thought this was an interesting moment of connection between Jane's mom's sign and it also demonstrates that young Chicanos were really engaged in listening, not just to UFW and what was going on both with UFW and FLOC, the Farm Labor Organizing Committee, but also with larger labor struggles. A primary site of resistance, and again, these documents are primarily from the collected documents that we gathered in 2013 with students. A primary site for resistance was education. And this kind of can be broken down. And again, Nora Salas's work is very useful in this early sort of her early excavating of this. It can be broken down to migrant education, the struggle for bilingual bicultural education, and the struggle around push-out rates. And these would be the ways in which young people were being pushed out of school as early as like fourth grade, right? In places like Detroit, in places of high urban spaces in particular, of high Latino concentration. However, rural Latinos were facing other kinds of struggles around, for example, migrant workers who would come out to school out of time, like because of the because of their seasonal work, would come to arrive to school late or have to leave early. And so a lot of these students, and also because of language difficulties, were being put into classes for at that time, the mentally retarded, right? And so they were experiencing this kind of pathologization because of the barriers to working. This is from a newspaper that was put out here in Lansing, Michigan, El Renacimiento, which documents LACED's struggle to take the state to task. The state, the Department of Education pushed forward a bill in 1974 to make bilingual bicultural education required throughout the state. But in fact, by 1975, this bill was being ignored almost across districts across the state. The concerned Spanish-speaking citizens of Michigan challenged the credibility, right, of a newspaper stating that the State Journal, the Lansing State Journal, in which John Porter, who was then head of the Department of Education, stated that some 40% of Michigan's 530 school districts are expected to offer bilingual education this fall. They knew, as a matter of fact, that wasn't the case, and they were demanding for these districts to comply, right, with the law. And what's interesting about this, too, is, this has a pointer, right, is that you can see the number of organizations, right, that we're organizing around this issue, including Mecha of U of M. I didn't even know Mecha had a U of M had a Mecha chapter. But this organization, which I'm going to talk a little bit more about, Mujeres Unidas de Michigan, is a really important organization that emerges at this time. In this paper, which was, I pulled this paper also just to show you that that this struggle for education was also waged at the university level, and actually is this sort of, it's this interconnection between university and community that leads Wayne State to, what is the liberal college in Wayne State? Do you remember what it's called?
Monteith?
Yeah, Monteith, right. So they started this program, Latino en Marcha. And the idea was to capitalize on all the youth that were interested in working in the community who maybe couldn't, we're having difficulty finding time to follow a full like 4-year degree and also do the work that seemed so urgent to them at the time. So Latino en Marcha became a way to earn college credit by doing projects in the community. It wasn't the totality of your college credit, but it would allow credit for doing those kinds of projects. This newspaper, Conciencia Libre, is an example of one of those projects. It was a community newspaper put out by students at Wayne State. This project, Latino en Marcha, later becomes Chicano Boricua Studies. This paper, I think, is from 72. I'm not sure, though. I don't, let's see. Oh, it doesn't. Not well. But what I find really lovely about this particular bit of paper is, let's see if I can get closer in. This is written by a parent, this essay about the condition of urban schools and the experience of her children. And she sort of calls out teachers for the way they're treating their children and why the push-out rates are so high. She basically talks about the formation of the Latino Parents Club at Webster, which is largely seen as the genesis of some pretty major organizations, social service organizations inside of Detroit. In particular, La SED is really pulling, which is a well-known organization in Detroit, is pulling from the Websters. A lot of those parents that get activated in the Websters Parents Club end up in La SED doing social service work, end up later getting social work degrees and degrees in education, going back to school. So it's a tremendous sort of confluence of energies. And in this other newspaper, I just want to pull out, first of all, noting that there's, you know, walkouts at Amelia Earhart Junior High and many other schools at this time, but also just pointing here to the different organizations, again, that we can see. You know, I have my students look at this to help begin to write the history of social activism in Detroit that really has gone unwritten. And we can do this from primary sources and begin to kind of cobble together an understanding of what, you know, it looked like on the ground to be doing social activism at that time. And a lot of these women that we interviewed were involved in these organizations. These are coming from their archives. And I want to say a little bit about politics. And by politics, I mean organized politics, organized political parties. Because of the migrant stream, the connections from the migrant stream, right? There's a flow, a constant flow of ideas and people moving from South Texas to Michigan. In South Texas in the late 1960s, there arises a radical third party called the Raza Unida Party, which is meant to disrupt, basically the strategy was to disrupt Democratic and Republican political machines that had been controlling those counties for many years. These counties were Mexican dominant. Sometimes, like in Crystal City, Texas, where Jose Angel Gutierrez was from, the founder of the Raza Unida Party, 90% Mexican. And so they were able to, through this third party, and by getting the vote out, especially amongst women, to win some major electoral victories throughout South Texas. The idea was they would transplant this up into the Midwest, where there were also communities with large concentrations of Mexicans. This is Jose Angel from, this is from the larger archival project that I'm working on. It's him at a meeting of the Raza Unida Party in Wisconsin. So there's a very concerted effort to go to those migrant, those spots where migrants either settled out or would regularly go to and organize Raza politics in those places. Of course, it took a different form here in Michigan because the demographic numbers just aren't the same. And the Raza Unida Party became more of a social advocacy organization rather than an electoral or a political organization that was after electoral wins. This is from the MSU collection, as a matter of fact. A student of mine, Maria Flores, scanned this but in 2010, and it shows evidence that I think is very interesting. Often the narrative says, Raza Unida came up in 72, and then Michigan started organizing, but we can see here from 1971 that Michigan is already organizing and thinking about, you know, the Raza Unida politics. This may have, this early start date is probably because we know that some folks from Michigan went to the Conference on New Politics in Chicago, in Gary, Indiana in 1969. I can't remember when that happened, I'm sorry. But there were people like Jose Angel and Reyes Lopez Tijerina were connecting with people in Chicago and the Midwest pretty early on. And so this is evidence of, you know, the fact that the Raza Unida Party predates this famous 72 meeting. And I want to just point to this because this is another important historical touchstone. This is, in 1972, Jose Angel Gutierrez comes up to organize Michiganders and Ohioans, and he meets in, I think it's in Muskegon, Michigan, and it's, this conference is called Mi Raza Primero, and I want to just kind of see if I can get closer to this. So this is Jose Angel Gutierrez with a woman who sadly has passed. Her name is Jane Gonzalez. She was a force of nature in politics on the west side of the state. And she was one of the people that organized to bring him up, along with other people who were working in Ohio and Indiana. And she was really irritated, and she's interviewed in this newspaper, because the men were all organizing and giving speeches, and the women were doing all the cleanup work and back in the kitchen. So she says, you know, this, if this is what transplanting the Raza Unida Party to Michigan means, I'm not down for that. And she's quoted in here as complaining about that. And so what she decides is that she's going to have her own meeting. And she is going to invite all the best Chicanas she knows from across the nation to this meeting. This woman is able to organize this meeting in less than 6 months. She holds it at, she and Olga Villaparra were the two organizers of the meeting, both of whom were disgusted with Mi Raza Primero. And by June of 1972, they organized the Adelante Mujer conference in South Bend, Indiana. And some of the women at this conference are indeed the leading lights of Chicana feminism. And so I want to think about these national, the thing that the project has uncovered for me is that we can't think of Michigan in isolation, that in fact, they're part, the women organizing in Michigan are part of a national network of organizers. This woman here is Lupe Anguiano, very well-known UFW organizer at this time, worked in a lot of Great Society programs in LA, worked to organize even like the Brown Berets, helped Maria Guadiana, a woman we interviewed, organize the Brown Berets in Detroit. Jane Gonzalez is the woman who was interviewed in that newspaper article. She and Olga were the Midwest organizers of this conference. This is Ruth Mojica Hammer, my collaborator's mother from Chicago, who was running for Congress at that time, representing District 9, I think. And Marta Cotera, this is my mom, in her sexy librarian phase. So the, you know, so my mother, for example, and Olga recalls, you know, going into a conference on economic autonomy for housewives, and where they were talking about, you know, getting paid housework and all of this stuff, a national living, not even national wage, a national, it was like a wage for women who weren't working, right? So they're talking about pretty radical stuff. And out of this conference emerge a couple of organizations that have been lost to history, but there's evidence of them that we've collected and also corroborated by some materials in the MSU archives. This organization, Mujeres Unidas de Michigan, it lasts maybe 4 or 5 years, longer in some places than others. It opens up in Saginaw, Detroit, Adrian. There's chapters in each of these places that we know of. And this is not the only organization that emerges out of that conference. Another one, for those of you who study Chicago, is Mujeres Latinas en Acción, which still is a social service agency today. So that emerged out of that conference, their action items to go organize, right? Some of the materials now, this is a woman we interviewed, Idalí Feliciano. She has papers here, and I think I even brought some more to you. She had a wonderful collection documenting the work of Mujeres Unidas in Michigan. And really, Mujeres is about creating kind of a sense of agency and autonomy, political autonomy for women. But it's also, its participants are also producing really interesting writing, like the Chicana and the Women's Rights Movement, a perspective which was written by, I can't remember, I wish I had the last page where her name is. The reports on the different meetings that they were having. We have conference leaflets. This is from the Cesar Chavez collection, but we actually have that same copy from Idalí Feliciano, so we're also seeing multiple copies. And, you know, so these organizations are engaging in broader conversations around Chicana feminism in particular that are very interesting. And in this collection, we have, for example, bibliographies, many, many bibliographies. I know MSU has, we've uncovered a couple of these same bibliographies in other archives in California and Texas, but the same copies. So we can see that there's a network. This is, and in fact, we interviewed, Rosemary Roybal is one of the women whose oral history we have collected. So in some cases, we have writings here in Michigan that we've uncovered that were written by some of the other women we've interviewed. So that's what I mean when we talk about a larger network. Maylee Blackwell, an historian, has written about the Chicana Conference in a book called Chicana Power. This was a national conference in 1971 that drew Chicanos from across the nation to Texas. Many women from Michigan participated in this conference. And this is an ad in a Michigan newspaper for this conference. These connections are also international. This is the list of women going from the Raza Unida Party, representing the Raza Unida Party, to the International Women's Year Conference in Mexico City in 1975. This is from the Marta Cotera collection. One of the things we learned, and I had contacted Diana about interviewing some of these women, is that women from the Midwest attended on behalf of Raza Unida Party, including Guadalupe Solis from Lansing, Michigan. So this is another way that we find names of women to interview through the documents themselves. I love this document because it's from Jesse Gonzalez to his wife, Juana, and it basically says to his Ruca, his girlfriend, and, you know, encouraging her to continue into her inquiry into Chicana feminism. So it also disrupts the notion that the men were constantly silencing the women. In many cases, they were supporting them in their endeavors. So he has gotten her this beautiful bibliographic study. This is by Adelfa Arredondo. And interestingly enough, it was commissioned by the State Department of Education. But it's on institutional machismo as a barrier to the success, professional success of women. This is a beautiful piece, essay by Ana Cardona, who's actually a Lansing resident and at the time was at U of M. She's a Puerto Rican woman and she's critiquing machismo also, both in Puerto Rican communities and Chicano communities. And this is something we found here in the MSU archives, which is very interesting because the Chicana Research and Learning Center was established by Evie Chapa and Marta Cotera, my mom, in Austin. And this is the concept paper. But it was here in Michigan. And we don't actually have a copy in Texas. So it's a very interesting, the reason I show you these materials is to show how this digital archive that is looking at all of these different sites is what it's illuminating is the networks, right, that were getting founded and formed through organizational meetings, the attempts to create national organizations, but also through the exchange of literature. So the class. As I said, the class that I taught in 2013 was really about experimenting to see if I could take the process of learning from oral history and archival collection into the classroom and what that would require. And, you know, one of the main things that I had to worry about was preparing my students to understand this complex history. And in the absence of, actually, before 2013, we hadn't, a lot of this material, the background I just gave you, I didn't actually know. There was one piece by Nora Salas on educational equity. There was a slim volume on organizing in the Midwest put out by the Gil Cardenas, I believe. But there was really nothing in the post-60s period. And so what I did was I had students read books like Chicana Power, Maylee Blackwell's foundational book on early Chicana organizing in California. Books like Living for the Revolution by Kim Springer, it's about black feminism, but I wanted them to understand how oral histories are translated into historiographic academic books. And so, you know, Kim did oral history and archival recovery much in the same way we were doing it. And I wanted the students to know that what we were doing was history. We read the wonderful book, actually, Latinos in Michigan, which is a great introduction for undergraduates because it's only like 70 pages long. And for a class like this, it's really perfect because it gives them a snapshot of the state. But we also looked at this book, 500 Years of Chicana History, because I wanted them to understand that Chicanas have been collecting their own archives for a long, long time. And Betita Martinez, this book, is basically a kind of photo essay from her own archive that she developed by being the editor of El Grito del Norte in New Mexico. Years of Chicana History. And it's very interesting because this book, it's like she threw her archive out on a table and like just organized it and pasted it up, and she was a radical newspaper editor. So a lot of these images come to her second and third hand, so they're remediated images. But I want my students to just understand that archival practice is not something alien to Chicanas, but in fact, something very instrumental to the ways in which our memory practices have functioned as political interventions. A key part of this class was I took my students on these oral history trips, and I tried to replicate as much as possible what going to California and doing like 7 oral histories in a row might be like. And so, but within the reason, right, of the class. So what we did is we broke up into teams of 2 to 4 students, and each student took on one woman. And the first thing they did was they had to find if there was anything on her anywhere, and usually there was nothing. Right, so then they were confronted with absence. They were confronted with what they knew, which was not very much, about the Chicano movement in Michigan, and what they and nobody else did knew. And what was interesting about that process is that it brought home to them that what they were doing was actually vitally important, that they were doing the work of history. Because most of, you know, whenever you ask students like whether or not they like history, they always say they hate history, right? So, you know, what we were doing was basically building something out where there hadn't been anything before, right? Scaffolding maybe, but nothing substantive, right? So we were gonna have to write these histories. So we interviewed Elena Rada, who's a labor organizer, a public historian. She was part of this university for, I guess, a year or two, pursuing a PhD for a while. She wrote, she's extensively documented the repatriation of Mexicans from Detroit. She's also a member of the Detroit Board of Education in Exile, as she likes to call it. And this was, oral history was filmed on 2 separate occasions. We had 2 students do the first and 2 students do the second in her home in Corktown in Detroit. We also interviewed a woman named Emily Martinez, who has been very active around migrant education and multicultural education in the state, but primarily in southeastern Michigan, or in Adrian, in particular in Blissfield. Emily came from a family of migrant workers, and she herself experienced very negative experiences in her educational experience, some of which are talked about in the newspapers that we documented. So the students were nicely able to sort of see what she was talking about in the newspapers, but also in the photos that her family collected. And we had something like 300 of her photos documenting migrant experience. They're totally gorgeous. Beautiful photos. This is Maria Guadiana, who's a social worker, educator, and labor organizer. She founded the Brown Berets chapter in Detroit, the only Brown Berets chapter, to my knowledge, ever founded by a woman. And she was very active in the SDS, the UFW, and on all sorts of fronts. She later gets sort of, she moves to Colorado for a while, and she goes into the sort of major Chicano national movement activities in the Southwest, and eventually comes back to Michigan to become an educator. And we interviewed Jane Garcia, who is one of the founders of La SED, is still the director of the social service agency. She has a deep, deep knowledge and history of social movement activism in Detroit. Her husband was a member of the Raza Unida Party in Detroit. She herself was moved from housewife to a member of the Webster's Parents Association that I talked about, to getting involved in La SED and in lots of different social justice activities in Southwest Detroit. She's a Republican. And it's a very interesting, it's interesting because she's not, I mean, you know her, right? She's as far from what you would expect from a Republican as can be humanly possible and still call herself a Republican. But she has a ton of fascinating correspondence. Like, she's in that position because she wants to get appointed to boards of major corporations in the region so that she can constantly bust their chops about not being representative enough. So there, she had hundreds, like her archive was hundreds of email or correspondences, letters to Ford, AT&T, like, I enjoyed your annual meeting, but I couldn't help but notice there wasn't a single Hispanic executive sitting on the dais, like just over, like hundreds of these, right? So it's a very interesting strategy that she has pursued. I wanted to show you some of the collections that we were able to digitize when we did interview these women. This is a picture of Elena Rada when she was a lot younger. She was, I guess, here around 18. She talks about growing up, being an insomniac, growing up in Detroit and being an insomniac, so riding the bus system constantly, and being very intrigued by the Black Panthers because she would see them on the bus all the time, and she went and volunteered when she was 13 or so at the Black Panther house, which was very close to her house, to be a babysitter and house cleaner. And so that was her first kind of introduction to radical politics. Later, she joins Chicano Boricua and says she learns for the first time about her own history, right, in the early 1970s at Chicano Boricua Studies. This is Maria Guadiana as a young girl. What's really interesting about her archive is that she had like 8 buttons, and that was the extent of her documentation of her involvement in the 1960s. What she did have was boxes and boxes of her father's archive, which is extremely valuable because he was involved in the Comité Patriótico, he was involved in the Mutualistas, the mutual aid societies, and it is incredibly fine-grained correspondence around like Cinco de Mayo and the negotiations that would happen around that festival. And like, you know, what it really demonstrates is a community building that happened in the 1920s in Detroit. So, oddly, from the person who was involved in most of the Chicano movement activities, we have the least document. You know, this is basically this and 6 other buttons are the extent of it, but we have a massive historical archive of Mexican activism in Southwest Detroit. These are some of the photos that I talked about from Emily Martinez's collection. Yeah. And this is a funny one because I was like, oh, who's that nice young man? And is that your cousin? She's like, no, that's my mother. And that was really embarrassing. But this is like, you know, working with people on their documents to get context. This is the kind of stuff that my students did. And this is where you can see, you know, Jane Garcia, we had all these flyers that her kids had made for when she was running basically coordinating. She was coordinating the Republican Party in this part of Michigan. And this is her when she served on the census. So she was doing very establishment kind of politics, but also running La Sed. It's a very interesting trajectory politically. And I just wanted to show a few scenes of what our archiving looks like. This is, we brought a bunch of archives back and did a 3-hour archive dive where we scanned and organized. And this was just one, this was Elena's archive. We generally do not take archives from the home. But Elena gave us 2 big boxes of stuff. She's like, sort through this. So we did. And this is the cataloging that students are doing where they're developing metadata to help mark the archive and organize it. Because you have to develop descriptions and tags and all kinds of stuff. Just a quick note on, you know, we use this class to beta test how easy it would be for students to use the Medici system. So this was in order to, you know, imagine creating a class cluster for someone else to teach, say at UIUC or at University of Wisconsin, that would include syllabi, course readings, assignment structures, and guidelines on how to use like Medici, best practices for scanning and that kind of stuff. So we tested Medici with these undergraduates and they did really well. It was very easy to interface. And all their writing happened on our class blog, which is connected to our website. And this is so that we can keep a sense of like how students are learning from the process. And this is my last little bit. This class was made possible by a local grant, a university grant, to enrich student learning. The grant was like either enrich it digitally or enrich it by community-based learning, and so we did both. I partnered with a faculty at the School of Art and Design to help. So we collected a bunch of materials in the fall. And I just wanted to note our partnerships. So the partner, what we established was we want to partner with El Museo del Norte, which is a Museum Without Walls initiative in here in Michigan. That's Diana is on the board, I'm on the board, and this is some of that we do basically pop-up exhibits. So exhibits that are fairly cheap to put up, and this is in a storefront adjacent to Café con Leche in Southwest Detroit, centrally located. This is another picture of that. This is our first pop-up exhibit. And so what we proposed with this Quick Wins grant was to partner with El Museo del Norte and with a, oh, this is Elena at our first exhibit. And with the School of Art and Design. And basically, I would have my students collect materials one semester, and then we'd hand them over to students in the School of Art and Design. And they had a Designing for Exhibitions course where they had to design with a community. And so we worked with them and with these other different agencies around campus to basically take what we did and not just put it up in the digital realm, but also have it be in the real world. We presented to multiple communities, so the students presented on their process at the Michigan. But then most importantly, we had a show called Las Rebeldes at the Boulevard House that basically was a historical narrative of Mexicans, because we had interviewed four Mexican-Americans, Chicanas, in Michigan, told through the stories, the oral histories of the women, right? So we were able, because, and this is where, like, even though like the materials we found from María Guadiana were really old, from the early 20th century, this is what inspired the show to be like 20th century history told through the lives of women, because we had the materials from collecting them from these women in a very unexpected way. So this is actually the opening at the Boulevard House. Social Work, School of Social Work has a partner with People's Community Services in Southwest Detroit, and they have this place called the Boulevard House, which we were able to partner with them to use as exhibition space. So this is the show based on the materials that we collected. And these are some of the students, and this is the last picture I'll show, which is some of the students from art, some of the students from my class, and all of the women that we interviewed. So that's it. Sorry it took so long. Okay. Well, currently, we can still use exhibition space at the Boulevard House, which is on 412 West Grand Boulevard. And we don't know the future of the house. It's on the market. We made it look so nice for this exhibit, and they put it on the market. Because it was kind of junky when El Museo del Norte had been partnering with People's Community Services for 2 years before this in the School of Social Work. So there was like a triangle of agencies involved in taking this old house and making it suitable for exhibitions of this sort, so we could have a semi-permanent place.
Great. Other questions or comments from here? What a tour de force. Talk about a force of nature. I think we know another
over.
One. Over to Dorothy.
Right. This is a really big question for historians, and there's a lot of anxiety about the decline of archives or the disappearance of archives. And I think most of the people in this room who use Facebook, Tumblr, and Instagram know that far from a decline in archives, we're in the age of the archive. Yeah. We're constantly self-archiving. The question is, who then will own those archives, right? Because it's not as if they don't exist. They're there. And in fact, some could argue that they're better preserved than ever because Twitter and, you know, and the Library of Congress is archiving every single Twitter. It's impossible to comprehend, but that is what they're doing. And, you know, Facebook owns our posts, and they're archiving that material, right? So I think the real question is not if there will be, but who will own it? And I think that that is a very pressing question for librarians, and many of whom, archivists, many of whom are, you know, like, do you guys use Gmail for your campus? Like, I think, you know, it makes sense to have a conversation about whether or not Google owns our emails, and to what extent, you know, in the future, if we want access to those emails, Google will say, well, there'll be a small fee for downloading that, or whatever. You know, I think that these are questions we really need to think about.
Well, and if I can just jump, I mean, one thing that has come up is this whole notion of the data apocalypse, that there's so much data that it begins to be really amazing if you've, you know, if you got that amount of stuff. I mean, the one thing about doing, I'm a 19th century person, the limited amount of stuff to troll through. Now, when suddenly you have a lot of
so
stuff
much.
To troll
yeah,
through.
Yeah, it's true.
For example, you could take a campus student organization of Chicana Latina activists. You could have every one of their Facebook entries over a period of X amount of, yeah, I mean, just the voluminous nature of that is just amazing. But other...
It's overwhelming, yeah.
Over here.
All right. Yeah, no, it's so important. And in fact, we did pull up like little pieces, glimmers of that in the archive, like in you know, it was not as central. Like it basically how I came up with those kinds of categories is from the oral histories that we did and from what they had collected. But in fact, you know, even in the material that they had collected, you can see, you know, art shows, and we're gonna interview Ana Cardona, actually, who was very plugged into that Latino art scene, which here was very much a Latino, it involved Puerto Ricans and Chicanos, and we'll interview her in the next iteration of this class, and I'm hoping, that was one of the reasons why I wanted to contact her, because I wanted to figure out what was going on with the art scene. And El Museo del Norte just got a massive donation of images by Julio Peraza, who was a Puerto Rican photographer for the, I guess, the police department and the fire department. So next semester, I also have to put students on scanning those materials, and it's a lot. So yeah, there is a huge story to be told on that.
And into the free night exhibit.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, the current, yeah. Well,
yeah, it's an incredible exhibit. I encourage people to go. And I want to say just one last thing about that. What was I going to say? Oh, that what I get really excited about with the digital archive is that if I have a graduate student or if I know of a graduate student, like I'm currently working with one from OSU who wants to document Adelante Mujer, and I can say to them, you know what? Go in there, see what you can find. Right, and let's start working on this. I mean, because we are literally looking at a blank slate right now. I mean, I don't say that very often, but it is, here in the Midwest, we are.
Yes.
So thinking about the idea of like a blank slate in the Midwest, I was really fascinated by this idea of like appropriating the process, right? Mm-hmm. And I was really struck by how some of the photos that documented the 60s period, you had people, like they're in the field, they're on the truck, they're with the cotton, they appropriate the space and make it their own. You know?
Oh, yeah, there's lots of examples of that.
Yeah, and they kind of take control, right? And,
yeah.
And I was interested in this idea of, well, in the digital archiving process, even the oral history process, did you all notice or take, make, you know, I don't want to say liberties, but to make specific choices about, you know, the ideas of documentation or directions that you took your approach to kind of appropriate this idea of documenting oral history?
Yeah, that's a really excellent question. I've been thinking a lot about this because I have to write something about it. But You know, it was one of the reasons why we've kind of moved away a little bit from calling it a digital archive and have been calling it more and more a digital memory project, because the weight of the archive and the kinds of practices surrounding, you know, what's understood traditionally as an archive, like in a library, first of all, in one group of people, let's say the academics, there's a hierarchy of values in this work, right? So the historians and the literature scholars will say, well, all you're doing is collecting. And then the librarians will be like, well, you're not collecting right. And so I'm like, okay, so what are we doing, right? And what value does it have? And so, you know, what I started to think about was about our process and the theoretical implications of it. Like, what exactly are we doing and why are we doing it this way? And reflecting on our process, partially because of the constraints of time. Like, if I go out and interview Maria Varela in New Mexico and I just have 2 days with her, I have 1 day to do her interview and 1 day to look at her office, which is packed to the ceiling, and decide what the hell am I going to take away from this in this 1 day. So it's not a comprehensive archive, right? So then what we do is we listen to the interview first, and then we talk about what in the archive she feels very strongly about, or what she thinks would illustrate best. Like, if we can only do 300 documents, what is best going to illustrate what she had to say? And so that's kind of, so yeah, it's not, it's a collaborative, it's writing the archive. Yeah, go ahead. Right.
What's valued more?
It's really hard to tell in the moment. Like, I find anyone who does oral histories will know this. Like, a lot of times, you know, you do an oral history and you think something's happening, and then you return to it like 5 months later and you're like, how did I miss that? Right? So I think it's been, you know, what I would say is that oral history requires ideally multiple iterations, like returning to the source multiple times. Unfortunately, we can't do that. We're constrained by resources, and this is one of the reasons why we are interested in creating partnerships with regional oral history projects who are interested, who live in the source, who have organic knowledge, right, of a place and a person, and can really spend time there. And so this is why the digital for us makes sense, because we have such limited resources and such limited knowledges. What we want to do is activate and mobilize knowledge, on the ground knowledges, to begin to sort of theorize, right, from there back into the archive. I don't know if that makes any sense.
Yeah.
And, you know, I mean, and I, what you said also reminded me of the question you asked, like, where I do see that claiming of space is in art practices too. I mean, and I would consider art practices even like from creating a mural and marking that space to exactly as you pointed out so lucidly, you know, the practice of framing a photograph and asking someone to stand in a certain way. Right. And these photographs are really beautiful. Like, I don't want to aestheticize them, but they are beautiful aesthetic objects. And whoever took them, which was her Theo actually, made aesthetic choices that are very moving and powerful. So I don't, on the one hand, while I don't want to say they're pure art, I also want to make a place for them as aesthetic choices that are claiming space in a migratory experience, right? So yeah, you could write a whole paper on that. Yeah. You're welcome to curate an exhibit of that material. I want to just add one thing. Is like, Emily called me just recently and she said she had been trying to get the Historical Society, the Lenawee County Historical Society, to take her photos. And they had expressed absolutely no interest. And so I guess someone from Blissfield or Adrian came up to see the show and went back and told them, you have no idea what these pictures, because we blew them up really big. We digitized them at very high DPI so we could blow them up like this, right? And so now I think they're going to do a historical exhibit down there and they want her materials. So, I mean, we don't want to just digitize. We want to make sure that the materials, after we digitize them,
yeah, exactly,
move into a repository, obviously. You know, that's the goal.
Now, just I'm going to remind you to sign in, please, if you haven't. I just have to say also that Cesar Chavez's birthday, I think, is tomorrow, from what Deanna reminded us. But we still have time for other questions. So other questions or comments that you have after this wonderful presentation? Yes, back here?
Yeah. Oh, good for you. Yeah?
My grandmother did some stuff.
Who was your grandmother?
Celia Durantes.
Celia Durantes.
She did translations for the law of legal stuff.
Oh, wow.
And I taught an immigration and naturalization course.
Oh, great.
But the organization is kind of gone. Like,
yeah.
I mean, they caught my program as a funding and stuff. So you talk at all about how organizations have changed over time and they've lost. Now they pretty much just do Google clinics. They don't call them.
Yeah. LASED is very diminished, and largely that's a result of, I mean, it's like, we know gentrification is happening in Detroit, but what preceded gentrification was the nonprofit industrial complex almost entirely in the state taking over that city, creating out of it a huge occupied territory. And so what that means is that, you know, very powerful nonprofits have come in and grabbed up, you know, infrastructure, land, but also huge grants, that parts of which used to go to the services that are provided by LASED. People's Community Services is another one, CHASS. There's many organizations that emerged in the 1970s have been really challenged in terms of funding. And, you know, I think it's another reason to document this work and the origins. Like, people take it for granted, right? But it emerged out of real struggle, largely from parents, right, whose kids were getting shoved out of school at that time, you know, and it didn't just happen by accident. It also happened in partnership with the church, which is a very interesting early history of LASED that not that many people know about. Father Kern and his projects in the community, right, eventually evolved into LASED, and they split, actually, because LASED needed to, as Jane Garcia tells it, they needed to advocate for women who were experiencing spousal abuse, and the priests were wanting to tell the women to go back to their homes. Right? So the split even in LASED from the church happens around gender, which is also another interesting thing. Yeah, but I think that in this age of gentrification, the claiming of space, especially in places like Southwest Detroit, but I'm sure ongoing elsewhere, you know, if we don't document these local histories, then we're in danger of losing them entirely.
Any last questions for Maria while we have this wonderful resource here? Well, please join me in giving her another round of warm ups.
Thank you.
So come back on April 10th for Maria Tapia talking about the fast food industry. Come back on the 24th to hear about longshoremen in San Francisco and South Africa. So please, thanks so much for coming.